Greetings and welcome to Catholic Cardinal Reflections, the regular podcast of the Catholic community at Stanford University. This is a weekly podcast of Sunday homilies and theological reflections given by the staff of the Catholic community and their guests. Today's speaker is Father Xavier Lavigetto and Chaplain Sharon Kugler. It is the fifth Sunday in Ordinary Time, and the readings are from Cycle B.
Jesus lifts Peter's mother-in-law's hand and lifts her up, and she responds like any Jewish mother or any Mediterranean grandmother. She cooks. I couldn't help think of my grandmother, the matriarch of my family. She was a powerhouse of goodness. She was the family's heart. But there are two strange aspects of this gospel and that most moderns don't notice. In the ancient world, the bride left her family for her husbands, while husbands remained in their father's house. So what is Peter's mother-in-law doing with Peter? She should be with her husband's family. The explanation is simple. She was the last. This really is a tale of grief. If she moved in with her daughter, it meant her husband and his family were dead. She had no surviving sons. And that is the plight of too many in the third world. She is destitute. Why are women and children the first to suffer? No wonder the prophet speaks God's outrage when society neglects the poor and the isolated. God turns his back on those who turn their back on the poor. But there's another surprise, and you've got to simply know this about Mark's gospel. Mark's God in Jesus is surprisingly tactile. He's always touching people. He's always touching people on the margins. He grabs Peter's mother-in-law and lifts her to health. He touches the leper. His finger will smear spit and dirt into a blind man's eyes. Later, they will invade a deaf man's ears. Jesus touches not just to heal, but to take to himself all that we are, our pain. Jesus touches and awakens the dead girl, and later he'll grasp the dead boy's hand and give him to his grieving mother. Jesus wants to touch us at the core of our hearts. He wants us to take each other by the hand and lift each other up. All the first cures in Mark's gospel were those with people pushed aside. So we ask ourselves, who do we need to reach out to? Who do we need to bring back to the center? And thank God I've got a preacher to answer that question, Sharon.
Thank you for the warm welcome and for the invitation. It is like coming home. When I left New Haven on Friday morning, they de-iced the plane twice. So I have to also say this is a welcome reprieve for my California soul. Occasionally, the sting of sacred texts sometimes goes unnoticed, and other times it's right there in one's faith, one's face beckoning further discussion. Simon's ill mother-in-law, unnamed in the story, touched by Jesus, once cured, goes on to serve. Jesus does not command her to do so. She is moved to do so. My sisters and brothers, I must believe that there is so much more to that story. She gets up, she welcomes the suffering, she serves. I suspect she's serving more than meals. I suspect she's serving a movement. Some of us get called, as the 12 apostles, all men did. Others discover an opening, whether by invitation or not, and step in. I'll leave it to the scholars to tell us more about the particular women who were, in fact, there in and around the house of Simon and Andrew in Mark's gospel. We know that some of the men who Jesus called to be his apostles were married. All had mothers, some sisters, even daughters. Of course there were women with Jesus. Of course there were women following him. Of course the women were there. They are unnamed, seemingly unimportant to the narrative, ostensibly invisible, and yet undoubtedly near to the unfolding ministry, not invisible to the movement, and certainly not invisible to one another. These are the women who are not invited or given permission to be in the story, who nevertheless, by and because of faith, are. Simon's mother-in-law was indeed spiritually elevated in the story, if we stop to look for more. When I was in graduate school in the 90s, my professor in biblical studies taught us well about the hermeneutics of suspicion. We were encouraged to think hard about and then look for those who were not appearing so readily in the text and to pull them into the story. My eyes lit up every time I thought about Scripture that way. It changed me forever, and my professor knew it and delighted in it. One day, while we were having a heated discussion in class about women and the need for more demonstrative leadership by them in the church, specifically the Catholic Church, a fellow student said quite bluntly, "Well, there were no women at the Last Supper, and so that's why we cannot have women leading the church." My professor looked squarely at me, mischievous smile on his face, and asked if I had something to say about that remark. Did I ever? Of course, looking back on my response now, it might have been a missed opportunity for real growth and change of perspective on the part of the other student, had I not gone to my default mode of using humor. I snarkily asked if he thought there was actually food at the Last Supper, and of course he nodded in the affirmative. "Well," I said, "there were indeed women there. The bread didn't bake itself." Again, taking the rather unwise, literal tact and not stopping at that, I then interrogated him on what account he was basing his assertions on. Was it merely the gospel text itself, or perhaps gazing at Da Vinci's painting assisted him in coming to this conclusion? Or maybe there was an Associated Press I wasn't aware of he was referencing. He was so sure of himself, and it was infuriating to me. The poor guy incurred my wrath, to be sure, but was the cause of women's leadership in the church advanced in that moment? I'm guessing not. If I had a do-over on that one, I would have circled back to a discussion of the hermeneutics of suspicion and invited my classmate to think along with me about who was missing from the story and, more importantly, what part they might have played in witnessing the ministry, death, and resurrection of Christ. I would have explored with him how we situate women in these origin stories of our faith, the women who have not been noticed, included, the women who might not have permission to be seen in the story. There are incredible women who have modeled what spiritual leadership looks like in extraordinary ways, who have preached, sung, and presided at this very pulpit. Some are leaders in the conventional understanding of the term and have led us standing right here, and others have taught us through their work on the side or in the back or outside of this space in the margins. Women's spiritual leadership cannot be confined at all. It is speaking truth, it is touching the hurt, it is holding the silences, it is joy, it is pain, it is loving kindness. It is smart, and it knows that the breath of God flows through absolutely all of it. One of my earliest introductions to what a different kind of spiritual leadership could look like came in the form of a friend of mine who is a woman religious. I've always loved nuns and wanted to be one until my parents firmly dampened that dream. Nevertheless, I've always been a fan. This is not the love of an uninformed, underexposed person from a distance, this love came from the cradle, from a place of deep appreciation for close relatives that were women religious, who laughed and played with me as a young child, and those who were my teachers right through high school. These women were the spiritual role models who taught me about joy, service, sacrifice, and humility. She was a sister of mercy, and her name was Sister Catherine, although to me she was Mopsy. I was Bopsy, and we called ourselves those names almost from the moment we met. More about that later. It was 1987, and I was newly entrenched in the work of advocacy and care for people living and dying with HIV/AIDS. We lived in Baltimore, Maryland at the time, and people were trying to wrap their brains around transmission and treatment for this terrifying plague that was decimating certain populations. I had just started a new job where I was tasked with opening a hospice for people in the last stage of AIDS. The hospice was funded by multiple religious organizations and was distinctly interfaith. At the time in Baltimore, hospices were not accepting people with AIDS. Many were dying alone, some even on the streets after family or friends had kicked them out because of fear, ignorance, or judgment. I had never felt more certain that my faith was directing my work. Mopsy, a.k.a. Sister Catherine, contacted me right away when she heard about the project. It turned out that she, without invitation or permission for that matter, had been caring for the very people I was trying to figure out how to house. Much to the initial consternation of her superiors, this retired teacher in her late 60s, small of frame and not in the best of health, was walking the streets of Baltimore, asking these men, most of them were men then, what they needed at that very moment. For some, it was a ride to a clinic. For others, it was food, a bed, lotion for their skin. She knew all their names, and she honored all their stories. These people living in the margins of society swallowed whole any small comfort Mopsy could conjure up. She would find money from various donors she knew from the past and tell them the stories of the people she was meeting on the streets and just kept at it week after week, month after month. The entire time she is speaking, she is smiling from ear to ear. Finally, I stop her and ask why the big smile in the midst of these heart-wrenching stories. She said, "I'm finally doing what God put me on earth to do. I'm bringing the good news of Jesus in the form of simple care to those in most need, and I've never been happier, and I've never felt more firmly held by God." I hired her on the spot. I confessed to her that I was worried I was in over my head with the hospice project, and in no time she jumped in with a plethora of suggestions and approaches to get it off the ground. Some rules were going to get ever so slightly bent so that we could forge ahead. Everything about her was at once traditional and anything but. She called us the Bopsy twins, with me in the title role as Bopsy. She liked it that way. We launched a plan. I would go to all the meetings talking publicly about the work and deal with various regulations that might block our plans. Within months, the first hospice opened. Most of the time, we were not sure we knew what we were doing. But all of the time, we knew we were meant to be doing it. It was some of the hardest and very best work in ministry I've done, and Mopsy, now well into her 90s, would surely say the same. Sister Catherine taught me about women's spiritual leadership in a way that never left me. It was a blessing beyond measure. She was fueled by the knowledge that God loved her and was working through her. She lived out her faith with such joy. She always asked permission from her superiors to do the work that she did, but she also knew, keenly so, that she would not always get it. So she asked, like the obedient nun that she was, but she did not wait for it. Rather, she went for it. With her severely arthritic hands, with a rod that was implanted partially up her spine, and with 70% of her vision gone, smiling, glowing, really, with every new person she met, every new guest we welcomed at the hospice. This place where people were going to spend their last days on earth was filled with laughter and human dignity. Mopsy would call herself a crazy nun with wretched bones. She was virtually invisible to many people in power, but she was everything to the people that mattered. They experienced the grace of God through her. Through our faith, we believe that Jesus is the incarnation of God's love, which makes it all the more demanding and frightening a bit to realize that for some people, we might be the only Jesus they will ever meet. I learned this firsthand from Sister Catherine. For so many of our guests, she was indeed the only Jesus they ever met. Sometimes we wait for permission with our hearts certain that the work of spiritual leadership is meant to be shared by all who know and feel that they are called to do it. Sometimes permission is granted and the door opens a bit wider. We are living in a time right now that is starved for a healing touch, much as Simon's unnamed mother-in-law received. Once lifted up, she began to serve, and a movement caught on. As I think of the women surrounding Jesus from the very beginning of his active ministry, when he is summoning the 12 apostles by name, when he's healing the infirmed, casting out demons, speaking truth to power, I am imagining these largely unnamed women and wondering about their approach to the pressing needs of their communities at the time, their responses to the longing of their households. Though their names are mostly unknown, their stories mainly live in our mind's eye without a written narrative. I cannot ever imagine church, living, breathing church, without them. Their eyes affixed on Jesus, their ears straining to take it all in, and their hearts and hands leaping into action. Of course, occasionally, without permission, always adding more to the story. Amen.
This has been a presentation of Catholic Cardinal Reflections, the regular podcast of the Catholic community at Stanford University. Director Gary Glover, with music by Albert Tommaso and Shane Clarkson. For more information, please visit our website at catholic.stanford.edu or visit our offices on the third floor of Old Union. Till next time, God bless you.